I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
Today we're going to be talking with Laura Lesniewicz. Laura is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at Rutgers University and a pre-doctoral intern at the Coatesville VA Medical Center. She's going to be talking to us about her research on the connection between biology and behavior and biomarkers of alcohol use disorder. All right, Laura, welcome to the show. We're really excited to have you.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be here. And, you know, thank you guys for having me, especially during the week of CPA. But yeah, happy to be here.
Great.
All right. Yeah. It's great to see you again or hear you again, I guess, technically. It's been a while. So it's nice. So we like to have all of our guests start off by telling us a little bit about their background and training. So you know what kind of expert we're talking to and a little bit about your journey. So if you'd be so kind to tell us a little bit about your training.
Sure. First of all, the term expert still feels strange being applied to me. I'm still in my doctoral training, technically, although I am almost done. I'm currently an intern at the Coatesville VA, as I, you know, you just mentioned. But yeah, in terms of my background, I went to Boston College for undergrad, where I did major in psychology. And that's actually where I got my initial like interest, I guess, in addiction psychology too, because I actually had a particular professor, Gene Heyman, who I still remember very fondly. I should definitely reach out to him. I haven't talked to him in a while, but he was one of my intro psych professors actually, and he's an addiction psychologist, more not clinical psychologist, more like experimental psychology. And, you know, he was just like super influential. And, you know, I took a couple courses with him. And actually, I did a Boston College is really big on like service learning and volunteer work. So I did a year long course, service learning course, where I volunteered in a like a long term residential substance use program. So I was doing that work, you know, 10 hours a week. Again, it was, you know, volunteer position, not necessarily like a clinical position, but that was my first kind of big exposure to the clinical world. And, you know, I just got like linked in, I got hooked in, you know, and from there I graduated from BC 2013, and I was lucky enough to snag a position working with, Marcia Bates at the Center of Alcohol Studies at Rutgers. And that's pretty much where I've been ever since. I was working with her as like a post-bac research assistant for a couple years. We just vibed really well. We loved working with each, you know, together. And, you know, it worked out that I got into the program at Rutgers, the clinical psych PhD program, 2 years later. And, you know, I've been working with Marcia ever since. And now I'm on internship at the Coatesville VA in Pennsylvania, which has been great. It's flying by. I can't believe it's already 8 months in and that I'm theoretically 4 months away from being done. It's wild. But yeah, that's a little bit about my background.
Wow. Very cool. Thanks for sharing, Laura. And I know Gene Heyman's work pretty well. Mm-hmm. He does like a lot of choice stuff, right?
Yes.
So we're really excited to have you on today to talk about something that we really haven't talked about much on our show yet. And that's sort of this connection between biology and behavior. A lot of your work sort of focuses on specifically biomarkers for alcohol use disorder, but biomarkers more generally. And can you tell us a little bit about what biomarkers are and why they're important?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in preparing for today, I was, of course, like looking up definitions of biomarkers and stuff like that. And, you know, there's all sorts of definitions out there. But, you know, I found one that I kind of like that I think sort of captures it. And it's really a simple idea. You know, it's really just that biomarkers are some sort of objective sign or indication of a clinical state, which can be measured reliably and accurately. So that's pretty much it, really kind of general. And the important thing is that they can be, you know, the term sort of indicates that it would be like a biological sort of marker, which it can be, but it can also be behavioral, right? So like, but for example, like performance on like neuropsychological tests, right? So behavior that indicates something about the way that your brain is functioning. And it's, but importantly, it's an objective measure, right? So that's really the important part of that. That can be, again, like measured reliably. But, you know, just to give an example of a biomarker that is, you know, really sort of straightforward and easy, and that would be body temperature, right? So body temperature is a biomarker of fever, right? Which is a clinical state. So yeah, again, just, you know, it's measurable, it's reliable. And yeah, so that's just a really simple example. Another one would be like blood pressure, right? Would be a biomarker, for example, like a stroke. And then one that's maybe a little more psychology related, I guess, would be one that I guess a lot of people know from their intro psych courses and stuff would be, enlarged ventricles in the brain for schizophrenia. Those are just, just a couple of examples.
Cool. So yeah, anything that's sort of an external or I guess internal, representation of something that's going on, it's a representation of a behavior or some sort of state, it sounds like. And what does this tell us, I guess, above and beyond what we can just observe, you know, either through self-report measures or maybe through like behavioral measures?
Yeah. So I think, you know, when I was thinking about this, like, I think there's so many reasons why biomarkers are useful. But if I had to really boil it down to like two main reasons, I would say first would be that biomarkers can tell us something basically about the mechanism of a behavior. So what I mean by that is basically like the biological process that underlies or, you know, through which a behavior occurs, right? So that's the first thing. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, but I just want to mention the second thing that I think, you know, makes biomarkers important and useful. And that's that they can inform targets for treatment. So, you know, I guess I'll talk about each of those things. So for the first thing, right? So the mechanism of behavior, this is a really kind of important thing. So like, for example, you know, we know, and by we, I mean like, you know, scientists and humanity and like whatever, you know, we pretty much understand how, like, for example, like arms and legs move and work, right? Like we understand about like the skeleton and like ligaments and muscles and like the mechanics behind all that, right? So therefore, because of that, we pretty much do a really good job for the most part, you know, treating, for example, broken arms or things like that, right? Yeah. And even if, you know, we know how to mend and rehabilitate those conditions, right? And even if we can't achieve like perfect success, you know, we understand, for example, like why a problem might be persisting, right? Like all of that is really well understood for the most part. You know, we know a lot less about how, for example, like psychological phenomenon and disorders are manifested physically, and how these conditions sort of develop and change over time. And that's where this research on biomarkers sort of comes in. Now, as it pertains to like addiction and substance use disorders, it may seem kind of straightforward, right? So like if people use more of a substance over time, they develop an addiction, right? But the issue with that is that it's not always that straightforward. That's not always the case. That's not always necessarily true, right? And oftentimes behavior alone is insufficient. It's an insufficient explanation for what's going on, right? And more importantly than that, even it might be an insufficient predictor of, you know, if people are going to develop a disorder down the line, right? So like we see that most often, I would say, in like the emerging adulthood phase, which is where a lot of my research has been, right? Like there's this whole idea of like maturing out phenomenon, quote unquote, right? Where a lot of individuals will be, you know, drinking excessively or like using substances in a risky way. earlier on in their 20s. And like by the time they're reaching age 30, they've sort of grown out of that or matured out of that, but not everybody does, you know. But
right,
behavior alone is not, you know, because it's normative to be drinking excessively, for example, during college or just like during that time, behavior alone is not a good enough way to be able to predict like who's going to mature out versus who isn't. Right. So again, that's where like where biomarkers can come in to be useful and helpful.
That's really interesting. I mean, I know there's some research, you know, so if you blackout drink, you're more likely to blackout drink in the future. And if you blackout drink, you're more likely to develop an alcohol use disorder in the future. There's a paper, I can't remember who the authors are right now, that showed that there are certain biological effects that are pretty long lasting that explain that relationship between blackouts and, you know, future risk for alcohol use disorder. So it's sort of like there's this sort of disconnect in time between, you know, the blackout drinking episode and then something that happens, you know, way down the line. And like you're saying, the mechanism can be found in these things, and they can help us understand the, you know, whether or not your behavior now is changing something and then resulting in this risk, or if something was already, I guess, an individual was already at risk.
I was just going to say that's like the chicken and the egg question, right? And it's, I mean, that's, I think that's where like the state of the science right now, there's this like big push, of course, across the board. But especially in this area of like biological markers and so on, of doing longitudinal work, because it's really hard to actually determine, to do like experimental research around this stuff, right? Like you can't just randomize people into like different brain conditions.
Yeah, a little unethical too.
Yeah, it's not like impossible.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, and what you're saying, you know, the example that you gave about the broken arms, and then I'm just trying to draw a line from that to something like alcohol use disorder is, you know, a bone or a ligament, if you tear that or break that, then that's it. It's the ligament or the bone, right? But I guess the psychological phenomena, the reason I guess there are less of these, I'm just making stuff up as I go. So correct me if I'm wrong, but it would seem that it would be because these are much more like abstract concepts, or they're a little bit more disconnected from like the immediate biological realm. So I imagine it's a little bit more difficult to find these biomarkers as well.
Yes, it's certainly more complicated. And that's not to like diminish. As I was like thinking through these examples, I'm like, there may be some like, physical therapist or something listening to this, like, oh no, it's like, this is like, way more
actually
complicated.
It's way more complicated than that.
No, but yes. I think it is, I mean, the human body, the human brain, mind, like all of it is really complicated, right? Mm-hmm. And behavior is not like located in any particular place in like the body or the brain, right? And it involves a lot of different processes. And, you know, there's like, right, we talk about the biopsychosocial model, right? You can't take this out of context of the person's social context, all that stuff, psychological, like all of that. So yes, it is complicated. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we don't have certain, you know, methods to try to identify, like, yeah, we're not going to be able to understand 100%, like, okay, this is where in the brain, like, you know, AUD happens or like whatever. We're not going to be able to point to like one particular place like that, right? But we can still, research can still get us closer and closer to understanding that like bigger picture.
Right.
Yeah, I think biomarkers are so interesting for a lot of reasons, right? Like it, as you pointed out, right? Like just simply measuring how much a person drinks, for instance, doesn't explain sufficiently differences in the development of alcohol use disorder or experiencing problems from drinking, right? That there are a portion of people who it's directly linked to the amount they drink, to the problems they experience and so forth. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole nother group, if not multiple groups, that develop alcohol use disorder even after controlling for how much they drink, right? So two people drink exactly the same, one develops alcohol use disorder and one does not. One way to explain that is differences in biology that might predispose that person, or changes that happen biologically in that person that are kind of a correlate of their drinking specifically, or their response to drinking biologically, that set them up to have more problems, right? And it's like right there where you can kind of zoom in and say, like, what is that process, that biological process that underlies this, modifiable? Right. And then that links you to kind of your point two, which is like, this gives us kind of targets for treatment. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that point.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, here, I think the most obvious sort of connection would be to like medical treatments, right? So medications, right? If we can understand some sort of biological process involved in a psychological disorder, whether it's addiction or whatever, you know, we could potentially create a medication that would directly target that problem. And that's certainly the case, right? For addiction, right? We know that there are lots of FDA approved medications and more that are being developed and so on, which are great. The other sort of less intuitive connection, but just as important one, would be to behavioral and psychological interventions. And here, I think like an interesting example to consider is that of panic disorder, actually. So with panic disorder, like, we as psychologists, like, we got that down pat. Like, we know exactly like how panic disorder develops, why it develops, like, what are what's happening in the body when people are experiencing panic, you know, how the fear develops over time. Like, we understand that whole entire mechanism, and therefore we are able to treat it really, really well. Like, there are some estimates that are like up to 100%, you know, success rate treating panic disorder. And I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, it's a coincidence that we have such a good understanding of how it works in the body and in the mind. And, you know, the fact that we're so good at treating it, right? Of course, with addiction and substance use disorders, like, we're nowhere near that same level of understanding. But we are moving closer and closer to that, right? Like, each little paper that comes out, each, you know, whatever, we moves us closer to that understanding. And, you know, the more that we understand about that mechanism and that process, the better informed we are to treat it.
I love this point, because I mean, you're absolutely right. Panic disorder, anuresis, sleep, you know, these are things that we understand very well as psychologists, in part because of our understanding of the biology behind, you know, why and how these disorders, these states sort of come about. And these are the areas that we are strongest at treating. And it really shows like the importance of basic research, I think, and basic on like an animal level, but basic on a human level as well, where you sort of have this feedback loop of, you know, oh, well, we as psychologists typically influence behavior. But then going back and understanding biology can help us then do that better.
Yeah, I think that's a thing that not a lot of people think about, that's kind of like layered in this conversation here, is that the idea that therapy, you know, psychosocial cognitive behavioral therapy, changes your biology.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. That like what we do in that space changes our biology in meaningful ways that help produce these kind of really great outcomes. Right. And that we have to look at it not just from like the top down, but also the bottom up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that helps us to understand some of these processes, right? Like, there are some really great work out there, but like, you know, Sarah Filson Ewing, who's, you know, shown like, you know, brain changes as a function of motivational interviewing, treatment and things like that. And I think that all allows us to understand that we can't just look at this in one way, mm-hmm. right? That we have to look at the bidirectional paths from alcohol use disorder, for instance, to behavior, and from behavior to alcohol use disorder, and vice versa, and brain to behavior and all of that. It allows us to really kind of understand this really complicated process that has a bunch of origin stories and a bunch of different outcomes. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the thing about addiction, right? It's like it's a condition of equipotentiality and equifinality, which says it has like 1,000 origin stories and 1,000 different outcomes. Right. Yep. And so I'm curious a little bit about where your work has taken you in the area of addiction biomarkers specifically. Like, what mm-hmm. have you been looking at? What's the literature telling us out there right now?
Yeah. Those are almost like two separate questions, because of course, like, my research is a very, very tiny, minuscule slice of the like broader picture. And I just have to preface, you know, this by saying I'm like by no means an expert in like all the different, right? Because like, you know, if we think back to that original definition, like there's so many different areas, including like neuropsychological testing and assessment, that like contribute to this like whole area of biomarkers. And even if we're just looking at for addiction, so I guess I can talk a little bit about, I'll briefly mention about, you know, kind of the state of the science in terms of like conceptualizing biomarkers in the field of addiction. And then I can talk a little bit about, you know, what I've contributed to that, the little bit that I have.
That sounds great.
That sounds outstanding.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to be taking notes over here.
Yeah, please do.
I think we're recording it.
That's true. I guess I can just listen to this later. So,
there's the current model, which is I think largely attributed to George Kube, but you know, NIAAA kind of in general, it's like been their one of their like larger efforts to sort of like make sense of all of this huge amounts of information that we have, right? And so the model that currently is the primary one is one of like these three sort of areas in which these like, well, it maps onto basically the larger cycle of addiction, but it also, those domains also are meant to sort of understand biomarkers as well. So I guess, let me think which one would make sense to, I guess it would make sense to think about the incentive salience piece first. So incentive salience, which is basically this idea that, stimuli associated with addictive substances sort of eventually take on an appeal like of their own. So that sort of idea, so like concepts like craving, right? Cue reactivity, things like that all kind of go under that general category. And that category is associated with what they refer to as the binge intoxication kind of stage of addiction. So like kind of, I guess what colloquially is referred to as like active addiction, right? So people talk about being an active addiction, right? Like they're using substances and so on. So that's kind of that area. Then we have the negative emotionality piece. So that's pretty much like exactly what it sounds like, right? And that's associated with like states like, for example, withdrawal, or, you know, other sort of negative emotional states that might be driving substance use behavior. And then the last piece, which is actually where a lot of my research comes in, is executive function. So that's actually thought to be, you know, a really important part to all this, like piece of this whole puzzle. And so executive functions, for those who aren't like necessarily familiar with that term, are essentially behaviors that are mediated by the newest part of our brain, so like the prefrontal cortex area for the most part. And they're things like planning, inhibition, right? So like impulse control, attention, problem solving, these like higher order functions that are like, almost like if you want to think about it, the behaviors that make us most human, right? That differentiate us maybe from other types of animals, right? And so there's a lot of research indicating that folks with struggling with addiction, on the average, of course, this isn't going to apply to every single individual, but on average, you know, are have some deficits actually behaviorally in this domain of executive functions. And so, and then just to sort of make the link to the like addiction cycle, I guess, the executive function piece is what they call, or is tied to what they call the like preoccupation and anticipation stage in that sort of like cycle. So again, that's sort of where my research sort of comes in. But before I sort of transition to talking about that, I don't know if you guys had any like thoughts or questions about that like model or anything that I can clarify.
I think that all made a lot of sense, and a little bit of my work sort of steps into to the incentive salience realm. And so, what about, so incentive salience, like for like a EEG biomarker might be something like a reward positivity or a P300 event related potentials. Negative emotionality might be something like heart rate variability, maybe.
Yeah, potentially. Or, you know, it could be like also kind of cue reactivity. So like emotional face task or something like that, like emotion recognition. And that could be, again, like the behavioral response as well as, you know, for example, like brain response, yeah. Emotional faces. That might be one example there.
Okay. Cause I imagine you're going to get into a few of the biomarkers for executive functioning. So I wanted to touch base on some of these other ones as well. So thanks. That helps a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nicole, yeah.
You good, Noah?
Sure. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah. I think I've worked in all of these spaces. So, I'd love to hear us talk about all of them. Right. But like, I think another one that's more behavioral perhaps for incentive salience, right? It's like attentional bias.
Sure.
Or attentional capture, right? So like the idea that things in the environment, like alcohol related cues, are going to capture your attention in a meaningful way because your information processing system is designed to kind of, you know, tune certain things out and tune certain things in depending on your goals and your learning history and these types of things. And so people have like these characteristically different, you know, responses to alcohol-related cues when they learn that that represents reward. And that's kind of like the underlying reward central, like centers in the brain are getting activated by these cues, right? And you also learn that they're interconnected with each other too, right? That like, oh, alcohol makes my mood better, right? And so like, there's like this link between them. So it kind of makes sense that it kind of becomes this chain that kind of develops over time and leads to, you know, very specific set of, symptoms and life experiences. So it sounds like most of your work right now is kind of focusing in on this executive functioning component. And so could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I would love to. So it's interesting because it's related to the executive function piece, but not in like maybe the way that you think, because it's actually not, or I don't know what you're thinking, but but it's actually, so I don't actually do, again, like sort of like preface, I don't do like, I haven't actually, and this is actually a limitation of my work and like, I wish, or my work where it stands currently. And I wish I could have incorporated like actual behavioral measures of executive function into my project, but that's just like, wasn't going to fit. It wasn't feasible to like fit it in with everything. What I'm doing in my study is I'm looking at, I mean, I'll explain what the study is, but I'll just mention this first, that I'm looking at a brain network, that is involved essentially, or has been associated with, pretty strongly in the literature, with executive function. So that's like the way I'm sort of the angle I come at it with. But yeah, so just to like explain a little bit about what, so this is my dissertation project. And it actually, it is funded by NIAAA. So if there are any NIAAA folks listening, thank you for that. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. But yeah, so it's a really, it's, I love this project. It's just very exciting. It's been fun to work on. But basically, you know, when I was a couple years ago, when I was thinking about, okay, like, what am I going to do for my dissertation? You know, and I want to write this grant, like, what makes me excited? What do I want to do? And I really wanted to do some sort of longitudinal work. You know, I wanted to look at like change over time. Of course, that's really hard to do for a dissertation, right? Because like, lo and behold, if you want to look at change over time, you kind of like need time to do that. Yes.
Crazy how that works.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But so what I thought was, well, you know, my advisor, Marcia Bates, you know, has collected so much data on different individuals, you know, in several different studies. Data on, like, I mean, neuroimaging data, first of all, which I'm interested in. But also drinking, you know, all sorts of drinking data, drug use, like all sorts of other sort of psychological variables. And one of the great things about Marsh, about working with Marsh and being in her lab, is that she's like part of her process, I guess, is that she's like tries to be pretty consistent across studies, so that, you know, time comes that you want to maybe look across studies. It's pretty like easy to do that. And so in this case, what I did was I said, well, let's just take these people who we already have all this really, really rich data on, and let's just like call them back and see if they're willing to come back and, you know, collect more data on them. And
that's
so
really smart.
Yeah. And again, kudos to Marcia for planning ahead. And speaking of executive functions, planning, thinking to get permission from them all
for recontact.
We had all that permission. And so I just, you know, called individuals from these two studies that we ran, these two, like neuroimaging studies, one of them a little bit bigger than the other, but, you know, not huge, but, you know, for a one PI lab, like pretty, you know, sizable studies. And, you know, I had a couple of my own inclusion criteria, but, you know, I had over 100 people who were eligible, and I gave them a call. And I actually, what I ended up doing is, when I called them to ask them if they were interested in returning to the lab, I, you know, said, hey, by the way, would you mind just answering a couple questions right now about your drinking? So I now actually have 3 data points, which is kind of cool. Yeah. So I unfortunately can't speak to the full data set just yet, just because I'm still working through those analyses. Yeah. But I do have some preliminary data that's super exciting that I would love to talk about, which is, so I guess before I get into that, I'll just again sort of briefly explain the, you know, sort of explained what I did, but in terms of like the design of the study. So, you know, at time one, we have, like I said, like neuroimaging data. We also, I didn't mention, we also have cardiovascular data. So their heart rate variability, respiration, stuff like that, drinking, and some psychosocial variables. At time two, like I mentioned, it was just over the phone. So I asked them about their drinking, just a couple of questions. And then time three, which I collected, unfortunately, I can't talk about the findings with respect to time three. But what I did was I brought folks back into the lab, reassessed their drinking and psychosocial variables. And I actually was able to we did some cardiovascular tasks. Unfortunately, we didn't have the you know, time and money to rescan them. So we only have the brain measures at the first time point. But, you know, we can still look at how, you know, and this is basically my main research question, is like, can we predict how people are changing in their drinking behaviors? And by the way, I also didn't mention, these are all emerging adults. So at time one and those two initial studies, all the participants were between the ages of 18 and 25. And by the time three rolled around, none of them were over the age of 30. That was one of my like exclusion criteria. So we're looking specifically at that like 18 to 30 age range, when we know that alcohol behaviors are changing drastically, you know, during that time frame. They change more, you know, drinking and substance use behaviors change more during that time frame than any other time in the lifespan, on average. So, right. So the research question being, or one of them being, you know, can we look at can we look at the way that the brain is functioning at that initial time point and use that, like, can that tell us something about how people are changing over time? And in addition, the cardiovascular measures, right? So the heart rate variability and so on, like, can those markers predict how people are changing in their drinking behavior over time? And so where the executive functioning piece comes into all this, like I said, you know, it's the brain network, right? So there's millions probably of different like markers that you could choose to look at in the human brain, right? Let alone then also adding in the cardiovascular stuff. In looking through the literature and deciding, okay, where do I want to like narrow this? I, you know, was pretty quickly decided on, you know, executive function and this what's referred to it. The network goes by a couple different names. I refer to it as the central executive network, frontoparietal network is also another name. There's other names, but I'm going to call it the central executive network. But there's this brain network that is well established in the literature, and it is really strongly associated with these executive functions that I talked about, right? So like planning, inhibition, problem solving, et cetera. So, you know, I'm not going to bore you guys with all the details of the actual fMRI analyses, but essentially, you know, we can derive a set of like measures to that are associated with like how that network is functioning. And, you know, drop those measures into a data set and then, you know, do your fun, like, you know, HLMs and stuff like that, looking at change over time and predicting, you know, predicting change over time. And so my preliminary data is looking at time one to time two. So just that like sort of initial leg. And what I have found is that basically, again, without getting into all the details, the brain network itself is anchored in these like five main brain regions. Okay. So if you want to think of it as like, again, it's like a network, right? Made up of these regions, and those regions kind of like talk with one another. Right. So the degree to which certain, nodes or like points in that network are sort of associated with one another, or the strength to which they're sort of co-activating in time is actually predictive of at that initial time point, right? That right. measure, if we want to call it biomarker, right, is in my data set predicted how people were changing, like whether or not they were increasing or decreasing in their drinking behaviors over time. Hmm. So then the relationship was actually a positive relationship, such that the stronger the connectivity, the resting state functional connectivity would be the like clinical term or the, you know, official term, the stronger that connectivity, the more likely it is that people would actually increase in their drinking behaviors over time, and then vice versa. Wow. So the lower the connectivity, the more likely it is that folks were decreasing in their drinking over time.
That seems like, I'm no biologist, but that sort of surprised me. I would have expected the opposite relationship, such that people with lower levels of connectivity between different brain regions would be more likely to be increasing drinking.
Yeah. So that's kind of what everyone usually says when I talk about this. and it's, if I'm being honest, like that was my hypothesis as well. In trying to make sense. And actually, if you look at the cross-sectional relationship, this is where it really gets interesting and hairy, is if you look at the cross-sectional. So if you look just at time one, that is the relationship. So there's a positive correlation. I'm sorry, a negative correlation, actually, between at just that one single time point between drinking. So like, for example, drinks per drinking day, or like binge drinking episodes in the past month, or like however you want to slice it, the relationship is actually a negative relationship. I think for me, when I think about this and I try to make sense of it, you know, when we kind of started this whole conversation, we were basically all saying how it's complicated. Like that to me is kind of the take home message. Like, you know, it's very clear, not just from my, you know, little study, but the overall literature, there's so much evidence suggesting that this central executive network is important to understanding drinking behavior and substance use more generally. Like there's just tons and tons of research kind of like bolstering that. And you know, where my study comes in is actually adding that like longitudinal piece. There actually hasn't really been longitudinal research to sort of show that. But it's very clear, like I feel really strong in saying like this central executive network, it's important when it comes to, to understanding addiction. But it's not necessarily, I mean, I shouldn't, again, I don't want to extrapolate too much. Like it's just one study that I've done and I'm still like looking through the larger data set and everything. But either way, right. It's never going to be just as simple as like a one-to-one, you know, okay, like stronger, this leads to more that like whatever, right. Yeah. Like it's just not that simple when it comes to like the human brain. But the point is, and right, like more connectivity or more activation or whatever, more anything in the brain isn't necessarily always like a good thing, like quote unquote good thing, right? I mean, again, it's like a complicated network of millions of neurons that are talking to each other. And there's all sorts of stuff going on that we just barely are beginning to understand. But the point is that, you know, we can, again, thinking back to that definition of biomarker, it's measurable. Somewhat reliable, right? Our methods are improving, but like, you know, somewhat reliable. And if we can measure this and if it can tell us something, then that's useful for us, right? Information.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so interesting to that you essentially found an ecological fallacy. I mean, I don't think it was tested in the way that you usually find an ecological fallacy, but you found a difference in the direction of the relationship at the between person level compared to the within person level, right?
Mm-hmm. Those are my favorite kind.
I love it
every time.
I love it.
Positive emotion that happens to me every time it flips sign.
It's amazing. We base so much of our and what I love about this is we're about half a century into like the neuroscience revolution, you know? And I think every science has its growing pains, you know, and it is kind of digging around in the dark until you find something solid to stand on. And then that's when things start to sort of snowball. But a lot of what's been done has been cross-sectional with small samples as well. And the reliability, I think, of some of these measures are in part because of small samples that have been tested so far. We're finally getting to the point where some of this stuff is cheap enough and available enough to look at this in new ways and look at it longitudinally. And what we find is not necessarily, it is contradictory, but it's not contradictory in the way that it discredits what was found before. It increases the complexity. It shows how much more difficult it is for us to understand than simply looking at something cross-sectionally or understanding sort of one part of the brain. And it feels like we're at this point now where that's going to be happening more often. We're going to understand that. And I think these are where the exciting advances start to come from when you see something that's inconsistent or that's in the opposite direction of what you expected, that's when you start to be able to understand, well, what if we targeted this in the opposite direction than we were expecting, like pharmacologically or with biofeedback, just to see what happened. You know, I think that's really interesting finding. And I know that it's preliminary. Obviously, it hasn't gone through peer review and all that stuff.
It's hot off the presses is what it is.
Right, hot off the press.
Fingers crossed, I'm submitting resubmitting a paper hopefully this week.
Resubmissions are you know better than
halfway
first
there
submissions, so, hopefully halfway there. You never know with some reviewers, but yeah, that's really cool. And where do you hope where do you hope this goes to?
Do you like the line?
The research. Sorry, I was unclear.
I mean, you know, as my background being, you know, my discipline, I guess, being in clinical psychology, I'm always thinking about clinical applications and like, what does this mean? You know, how can we use this? And I mean, I would love, in terms of like where I would love to see it go for myself, like I would love to be able to run like a larger study that was basically designed initially to, you know, this was the project that I'm describing. I always refer to it as my ad hoc longitudinal study, right? Because it wasn't originally designed that way. There was a lot of attrition. I mean, it's not even technically attrition because these people didn't originally agree to come back, right? So I don't even know if attrition is the right word, but like, you know, we had a good number of people come back, but anyway, I would love to do the study like for real, I guess we'll say. Yeah. Like I was saying before, add in the actual behavioral measures, you know, see like how actual behavioral measures of executive function are actually playing a role into all this. And hopefully like all of that evidence kind of converges on the same conclusion. Yeah. And then in terms of clinical implications, right? Like for me, like when I think about, for example, like CBT for substance use disorders, or even like motivational interviewing, right? Like executive functions, you don't really think of that in that way, but you know, there are skills like in CBT, like we teach skills like planning ahead, right? Like the cognitive restructuring skills, like those are pulling on those executive functions, right? And so really like understanding, like maybe that needs to be like a bigger part of the work, right? Or for certain people. You know, maybe you don't just spend one session on that. Maybe you spend more time on that, or whatever. And then in motivational interviewing, right? Like we talk about making a change plan, right? And so just being kind of more explicit on pulling on some of those executive function pieces and like what that might mean for recovery.
Yeah. I've got a question for you. What does it mean to have more or less connectivity in those areas?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So basically I'll explain what functional connectivity is or like how it's measured. Basically it's essentially a correlation in time, if you want to think about it that way. So when you measure in fMRI, right, like you're scanning the person's brain while they're either doing some sort of task, or in the case of my study, actually, when they're not doing anything at all, and which is called resting state functional, you know, it's called the resting state task. So like they're literally, there's a few different paradigms for resting state, but one of the most classic ones is, you know, just focusing on a fixation cross for like 6 minutes, 10 minutes, however long it is, like literally doing nothing, staying awake, but that's about it. But the point is, right, you're measuring the brain function over a period of time, right? And you can look at specific regions in the brain, or, you know, what we call voxels, which are basically the smallest possible unit. You know, if you want to think of it like a pixel on a computer screen, but it's like a 3D pixel. In the brain. I mean, it's not literally in the brain. It's like
the image, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's how we capture that information, right? That's the smallest resolution possible, right? Is one voxel. And you know, in my case, it's like, 3 millimeter voxels, in the brain. So, you know, you can look at how the time series signal of that brain function of that one particular voxel, or, you know, a region in the brain or whatever, right? So it'll look like a signal, like a squiggly line over time of like, okay, it goes up, it goes down, depending on what they're doing, or, you know, in the resting state, just, you know, that kind of baseline fluctuations, which there are reliable sort of baseline fluctuations in brain function, just when you're not even doing anything at all. And what functional connectivity measures is the degree to which the oscillations or fluctuations over time between two, again, either like voxels or brain areas, so like clusters of voxels, are correlated with each other. So when the one signal is going up, the other one is also going up. And when the other is going down, the other one is also going down at the same time. Or to what degree are they tightly connected like that, right? Those time series how closely are they correlated? And so, and by the way, this can be in the negative relationship too, right? So like a perfect, right? Like a perfect positive connectivity score or whatever we want to call it would be like every time, like exactly as the one signal goes up, the other one also goes up. Right. Exactly when it goes down, the other one goes down. But it can be negative where when one goes up, the other one goes down.
Right.
Right. And those can be like equally strong. You can think of it essentially, and we do actually measure it with correlation. Like the actual index is interpreted almost exactly like a correlation,
right?
So between zero and one. We do transformations on that. It's not exactly zero to one, but like, again, without getting to the technical details, like that's essentially how it's interpreted.
Yeah. So more connectivity in this case would be, like stronger relationships between all of those areas.
Right.
So that's interesting. So I'm trying to like comprehend what that means, like behaviorally or experientially or whatever. And it kind of sounds like all of these areas, which maybe are supposed to operate on their own, or maybe less so in tandem with everything else when they all start to be more connected. I am not a biologist, and that's probably clear.
No.
Conversation.
You're good. No, I mean, you got it. I mean, the other piece that's interesting to all this is like that network part, right? So remember I mentioned like the central executive network. So networks of brain activation, it's really interesting. It's basically like, honestly, like the first time that I actually like calculated this on my own data set, I was like, my mind was blown because it's so replicable, like, so I mentioned the resting state, right? So like when you have participants just like in the brain scanner and they're doing nothing, they're literally just staring at a cross. And you take that data, so those time series of all those different voxels in the brain, and you dump it into this like fancy schmancy like statistical model and called an independent components analysis. And what it does is it'll take all of that data, all of those time, you know, thousands of time series, and it'll generate these networks, basically. So like areas of the brain or groups of voxels that for the most part tend to have like stronger connectivity with each other. And when you do this analysis, you tell it, okay, I want you to give me 10 networks, or I want you to give me like 20 networks or whatever it is. Usually people will do like around 40. You get an output and you'll get noise components. So stuff related to like motion, which usually looks like a ring around the edge of the brain, right? So that's like related to motion. You might get signals related to like other things that you don't care about, like cerebral spinal fluid and like stuff like that.
Right.
But then you also get these super meaningful, like gray matter networks of like brain activation that like are, again, just, you see them in the literature and you think like, oh, I'm going to do this. Like my data isn't going to show this, but like, they're there. Like you see these networks and you can,
it's consistent.
And I've calculated them in multiple different data sets and like, they will always show up. So like, for example, the default mode network is like the big one. That was the first one that was discovered. And then you have like salience network, the central executive network, which is the one I'm looking at. There's this affective, like there's a whole bunch of them. Like those are probably some of the bigger ones. But it's like, you will find these networks that like our brain, like is organized. Essentially the function is organized, even just at rest. Like you're just sitting there doing nothing, but your brain is like organized in this like certain way.
Yeah. Wow. Very interesting. Thank you for describing that. That helps me a lot.
Yeah. No problem.
No, agreed. I think that's super important to just kind of help us understand a little bit about how all these things kind of interrelate with each other and how we measure them and how we're able to use them as, you know, meaningful pieces of information that can show up for a person, as clinical psychologists like yourself, right? Like, and so I was wondering if we could pivot now to a little bit to the things that we do at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the show, we have people kind of give some take-home messages about their work. And one of them is about what you think one of the take-home messages of your work and what we've talked a little bit about means for people in recovery, which I think is like an important topic, and I think is really kind of related to where you were kind of going at one point of our conversation here. So I was just wondering if you could just highlight that for us.
Yeah. So I think here, sort of like I was talking about before, you know, the main thing is kind of the main finding, right? So like, you know, the research kind of indicates that in a lot of individuals, again, not everybody, but a lot of individuals who are struggling with addiction also have some, you know, are struggling with some of these executive functions, right? And then what my research kind of adds to that is that the brain, there's brain function actually, the brain function associated with those behaviors may also be associated with how individuals change in their drinking patterns over time. Right. And in my case, you know, for my research, particularly during your 20s, but potentially at other times as well. And so for me, the like kind of clinical take-home message from that is like, you know, working, like having that knowledge, you know, and knowing that these executive functions are an important thing to focus on in treatment, right? Especially if you know that you're the type of person that struggles with impulse control, problem solving, planning ahead, like those aren't your strong suits. Like those are things to think about, you know, and those are things that are like related to recovery. Right. And like, whether you're working with a therapist or you're kind of like out there on your own, like remembering like those are an important part of the whole picture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What would you say, for practitioners?
So, I guess for practitioners, it's sort of a similar take home message, I think, to what I was just talking about for folks in recovery. But, you know, a little bit more on like the clinical side, you know, focusing on these executive functions potentially as like a part of treatment, but also as like part of assessment as well, you know, and just like weaving that into, you know, your assessment battery, I guess, when you're assessing folks with addiction, like assessing their executive functions, whether it's, you know, officially quote unquote with neuropsych assessment or just, you know, clinical interviewing type of thing. And then the second thing that I would say, you know, is really for practitioners as much as possible to, as much as you can, stay on top of the research, right? And like what's coming out, because there's always these new information that's coming out that really can inform practice. And as researchers, that's like, sometimes I feel like that's the hardest part of our job is like getting, like doing the actual science. Sometimes I think is like the easy part. It's like getting that information out there and put into practice. Like that's the hardest part of what we do, you know? But at the same time, and that's, I do think that onus is on the researchers. I believe that. At the same time, you know, I think practitioners also have a responsibility to stay on top of it, right? And keep reading what's out there and so on. So, yeah.
What would you say to policymakers?
Policymakers, yes. This was one that I was like thinking about for a while. And you know, again, as like a graduate student, it's hard to be put in the position to say, yeah, this is what I recommend for policymakers. But I think, you know, in thinking about it, what I would say is, I don't know how much this is even really related to my work in particular. I guess the connection to my work would be like, you know, there's so much of addiction, you know, the risk factors and so on that are completely out of people's control, right? Like biology, genetics, like, you know, whatever it may be, like completely outside of people's control. And yet there's still this insane, massive societal stigma associated with addiction, you know? And so I guess, you know, to whatever extent policy can combat that stigma, I don't know exactly what that looks like, you know, it really isn't my area, but to whatever extent, you know, policy makers can work toward reducing that stigma, like the better, you know, we know that that's reducing stigma increases treatment seeking, which of course decreases the overall public health burden. So.
Right. What about underserved populations?
Yeah. So this is here. I think, you know, I would just think about like resources, right? Like resources for treatment and for, you know, I guess my biggest take home message would be like being an advocate for your own treatment, right? So staying educated, right, on what addiction is all about, right? Like free podcasts like this one, right? And you know, in terms of it's hard, you know, it is really hard. Like treatment is still really inaccessible for a lot of people. But one thing that I always recommend for folks, which I think, you know, is really great, is you know, seeking treatment through like research studies, because, you know, not only are you oftentimes not having to pay for that treatment, but you may actually be getting paid to be involved in that treatment. And you are getting the most sort of like cutting edge thing that's like coming out. Right. And then, you know, I got a shout out to the veterans out there, you know, working at the VA. And, you know, if you are a veteran who isn't linked up with the VA, like get yourself linked up with the VA, because the VA is awesome. I mean, really, like I've worked in, you know, I haven't been in the field for all that long, but, you know, for the amount of time that I've been in the field, I can say like the VA is just top notch when it comes to like evidence-based care. I mean, they're on the cutting edge of all that stuff. So, yeah, I guess that's what I would say.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such an enlightening conversation that we often don't have. And so I was really glad to be able to have you. We have one last question that we, before we get you out of here. So you've been so successful in your career so far. And we were wondering if you have any advice for trainees that might be listening to.
Yeah, they're... I don't know. There's always so much that I would want to say to like current trainees and so on. I could like talk forever about that. But if I had to like boil it down, I think I would say first and foremost, just take everything one step at a time. Like graduate training is very stressful and it can feel super overwhelming at points. And I always tell this to people, I'm like, there will be a time where you strongly consider dropping out. Like that's going to happen. That's normal. But you know, just taking it one step at a time. And you know, of course, like thinking ahead and all that, but just focusing on the next step, you know, like the next best thing, it'll get you there little by little. And then the other thing too, which I'm always having to remind myself, is that there's no like single right or correct like path to success, right? Like, and this is something that like, yeah, for me, I'm always worried about that. Like, oh, well, if I make this decision for the next step, like, how's that going to affect, you know, is it the wrong choice, you know? But I've really tried to talk to a lot of people. And this is where like Division 50 for me has been huge. You know, it's just like talking to other people in the field and what their paths have been and what got them there. And there is no single story. There's no single path. Like everybody does it differently. And the like more interesting, the better, and the more non-traditional, the better. And, you know, just keeping that in mind, I think is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point. And everyone has such different research interests and, you know, programs that sometimes I think it's easy to look at someone and wonder if they're doing it right and you're doing it wrong. But yeah, have faith in yourself.
Yes. Yes.
One foot in front of the other. Thank you so much, Laura. That was great.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for having me. This was super fun. It really just felt like just hanging out and catching up. So I loved it.
Good. Agreed. That's what we hope for. On the next episode of the Addiction Psychologist podcast, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Deborah Kaysen. Deb is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. She's going to be talking us about the connection between PTSD and alcohol use disorder and the best way to treat those two co-occurring phenomena.